general fund lottery revenue update in the December forecast, and a review of Measure 76, the highway cost responsibility. So I'd like to start off with the revenue forecast. Tom Petoskey and Sarah, and where's Ed? Oh, there's Ed. You changed. Ed, I guess you're going to start with the summary.
Okay. Okay, first start. Hey, good afternoon. I'm Tom Petoskey, the state economist from the Office of Economic Analysis. With me today is Sarah Gates, economist. I'm going to give you a quick overview of the Oregon economy, and then Sarah will give you an overview of the general fund situation based on our December 1 forecast. So you should have a handout in front of you, and on the first page is just a summary of the economic forecast. And just very briefly, the story that we're trying to tell here is that Oregon was sort of disproportionately hit by the Asian financial crisis, and we had quite a slowdown coming into 98 and then part of 99. So what we're looking at right now is for the Oregon economy to generally slow down to a very, in a sense, slow pace relative to what we were used to in the mid-1990s. And that should then continue on through this biennium period, the next biennium period, with a slow but positive growth rate. Some of the sectors, manufacturing, we're expecting to bounce back after being hit pretty hard by the financial crisis. High-tech declined about 4.2% in jobs in 1999. We're already starting to see the fourth quarter starting to come back a little bit, and we expect that to bounce back. But it won't be till about mid-2001 to late 2001 till employment reaches back up to those levels. Lumber and wood products, a little bit of a brighter point in 99, but then they started also to decline once again. They're still on a secular decline. We expect that to be a slow secular decline through the next two bienniums. Those are just some quick sectors. If you can turn to page 3, one of the things we're looking at a national level is whether this expansion will keep continuing. We've got two graphs here to compare the 1960s expansion, which is the longest one that we've been involved in, compared to the 1990s. And if we make it to February of 2000, this expansion will be the longest one in history since the mid-1800s. And I want you to keep that in perspective, because just as people believe that the stock market should always have double-digit growth year after year, that is also, in a sense, unusual over the history of the economy. So some of the things that are a little bit different about these expansion, the top graph on page 3 shows how volatile gross domestic product growth was in the 60s and how it's very sort of solid but stable growth in the 1990s. And that's been very helpful in terms of being able to predict and forecast of what's going on with the economy, especially by our Federal Reserve. And the bottom graph also shows you that inflation really isn't much of a problem yet. And that's generally what stopped growth periods. You have high inflation, and then the Federal Reserve puts on the brakes, and the economy goes in a tailspin. Page 4, the exports on the top there were hit pretty hard, and we're still seeing some problems with lumber and wood products and agriculture products. But high tech has come back, transportation equipment is coming on strong, and it looks as the Asian economy start to recover, especially, and there's also some good strong growth in Europe, that those exports are still going to continue to grow. And so that's a brighter point for our economy. Very briefly, on page 5, gives you some quick overviews, history of the overall employment growth in Oregon compared to the U.S. And you can see that since 1985, in 98, we had our first year where we were below the growth of the U.S. economy. We're expected, though, to be higher growth in the outer years. Manufacturing growth on the bottom also took a dip in 99, but once again, we expect that to be able to bounce back up. On page 6, on the top, we're looking at Oregon and high-tech employment growth, and you can see that the high-tech in 99 98.99 dropped below the U.S., and that's indicative of the disproportional impact that the Asian financial crisis had on the Oregon economy relative to the U.S. And then the bottom one, wanted to give you some sense, we're seeing some higher mortgage rates, we've seen some population slow down in growth, and in the construction area, we're also seeing some slowdown there, but relative to the rapid growth it had, double-digit growth in 95, 96, it's starting to level off. And so as its importance in the overall employment is sort of staying at this sort of high historical level. And that's really sort of general story of what we can say for this economy. It's a sort of a leveling off. We've been way up in the stratosphere, and we've come down, but we're still at a fairly good situation. We're still at a fairly good growth rate. It's just not going to look so spectacular like it did in the mid-1990s. It's coming down more to sort of historical norms. Page 7 gives us some indication of how our sort of citizens are doing relative to the U.S. in terms of their incomes, per capita income, and a ratio of their wages and salaries to our employment. We've been doing a little bit better coming out of the late 80s, a little bit of bump there in the 90s because we did have a little bit of slowdown. We expect that to continue to improve over time. And lastly, page 7 on the bottom, there's some growth inflation. Now, these are important to look at because these inflation factors are going to work into various programs and their expenditures that you'll be looking over in the coming year. And you can see that various levels of inflation, various measures, like the gross domestic product implicit price deflator, the bottom solid line, that's our best overall sort of measure of inflation. And so you might think that might be a measure that would affect sort of current service levels. And notice that rather than the sort of higher inflation as we started in the 1990s, that's really come down and is more in the sort of 2% range. And we expect that to continue out into the outer years. The U.S. Consumer Price Index has also come down since 1990. This is the index that's used quite often in cost of living adjustments and in wage increases. But that also has settled down more into the 2%, maybe 2.5% range relative to the high that it was before. And then dramatically, the U.S. medical cost deflator has come down quite a bit from 1990, and that's expected to stay at some fairly lower levels, but bouncing up to around the 3% range as we get to the outer years. That brings us to page 8. Because this is called a forecast, we'd like to say that we know the future for certain, but we don't. And so we have to take into account certain risks of this forecast that's coming up. And so I have a couple of items there that's listed. Really what I want you to see about these items is that the downside is sort of relatively more highlighted than the upside of what may happen. In that, as we're coming into our next biennium period and out to 2003, there's probably more factors at risk to slow the economy down further than I think there are probabilities of the economy even speeding up more than what we're forecasting right now. So that's sort of overview of the Oregon economy. I'd like to turn over to the revenue side to Sarah.
There's your other question. Let me see if there's any questions at this point. Representative Beck?
Do you see or foresee any initiatives out there that would now have an impact on the past? Have an impact on the Oregon economy and investment in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, no, I don't see any really that directly related at the Oregon economy that may have an impact. There is some work going on right now with e-commerce. Depending on how that comes out, and it seems like it's everything under the sun they're discussing, that might cause some firms to either want to, you know, locate in Oregon for that purpose. But that's a real iffy outcome.
Let me ask you, it seems like for a number of years we've been hearing that the Asian economic slowdown is going to impact Oregon, and it hasn't. And now it seems like the Asian economy is sort of pulling out of its slump, but now it's impacting us. So do you think overall, maybe given a 5 or 7 year time frame, that's been more of a spike and less of a longer-term impact on the on our state than your than was originally predicted? And will we recover faster than maybe we could have foreseen 3 to 5 years ago?
Representative Strobeck, really, I think you look at the numbers, you see starting in even sort of late 97, especially our exports, agriculture, lumber, wood, really started to fall there. And if you take a look over at our other main manufacturing industries, second quarter, third quarter, 98, they were really going negative. And this was the time corresponding, I think, when the financial crisis was occurring in Asia. So I do think we were definitely impacted by it. What we're seeing, though, probably is that as those industries started to slow down, there was a further ramification throughout the economy where we started to see things like the finance and real estate area, services, trade, retail. Those started to slow down as sort of a consequence of our manufacturing slowing down. So it sort of trickled out, and it took a few quarters for that to occur. And we started to hear the news about Asia doing better, and it has. And so what we're seeing is that we're starting to pull out of that, but with the ramifications that happened, it takes several quarters for us to finally start to see the light. And I think we're finally going to see the light coming into 2000. But, you know, we're looking basically at 1.9% growth for this year, and we're looking at the same growth for next year. But we're not seeing any further declines occurring.
I guess my question was more that maybe can you say that the impact on Oregon was less severe and less long-running than maybe we would have thought? At least that's kind of my impression from hearing these reports over several years, is that, you know, when I heard, wow, the Asian economy really took a serious dive, but our economy was at least strengthened by other growth factors, by the strong U.S. economy, et cetera. So maybe it wasn't quite as rocky a ride as it could have been. And obviously there's a lag time between both the decline and the recovery and how it affects, you know, the residual impact back here in Oregon. So I guess my question is, was it as deep and as long as you expected it to be? And
Representative Strobeck, it was not quite as deep as we first thought it was going to be back, say, a year, 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. economy also was almost like an island to itself out there in the world. It was growing very rapidly and seemed to fool all forecasters in terms of its strong growth. And that also helped pull us up, too. So that overall, the U.S. economy was not as impacted as strongly by the Asian downturn as what people felt. We, I think, in turn, too, probably were not as impacted as much. But relative to the U.S. average, we were disproportionately hit a little harder than what the U.S. was.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
This is a related question. I've heard some pretty wild projections about job growth in the Northwest related to opening trade with China. And then in light of all the attention we have had pretty recently to the World Trade Organization meeting and the failure to reach agreement there, is that going to have any impact on our employment situation and our economy here?
Well, China's a real wild card. If definitely the markets would open up, we would see freer trade with China. Yes, especially in our high-tech sector, lumber and wood, agriculture, all those would do quite well by opening up trade with China. Now, on the other hand, China's economy has been in somewhat of a deflation situation. Their prices have been coming down to the extent that they might start to devalue their currency. That would then sort of hurt our ability to export to them. So in my own mind, it's a very long term. If they open up trade, it's not going to be something we would see very rapidly. This would be something, well, 5 years probably down the road. But I think the freer the trade we have, it's just going to be more positive for us. But you want to keep in mind, there are always, with free trade, winners and losers. And so there will be some sectors that will do better.
At that point, driven home lately.
Okay.
The losers are these small business owners in Seattle. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Recent report that I saw indicated that productivity growth in the U.S. economy, I think, went up 4% in the last quarter on an annual basis. And consequently, wages were able to go up significantly without driving inflation because there was the productivity to support the wage increase. Is that taken into account in these projections? Because it seems to me that if you're going to have productivity increases of 4% and 5% a year, which is driven by technology, I think, primarily, what that does is it allows incomes to rise significantly without creating inflationary pressure, which, of course, is going to spin off more tax dollars.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, that is true. We've had some great productivity gains in the U.S. economy. And that does allow, as you said, wage increases to occur without having to push up prices. The question comes down to if labor markets become tighter than they already are. It's, you know, the U.S. unemployment rate's at 4.1%. Do we have room to get down to 3.8 or 3.5%? Before even then, there would just be sort of stealing back and forth of workers and a driving up of wages that could even be higher than productivity. But as long as that isn't the case, and if the productivity can be above what the wages are, then that would be the case. Wages could go up, even though you're not having a huge employment gains necessarily, you're having some very healthy wage gains, and that would translate into higher tax revenues.
Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up. I mean, is it possible we're in a new economic era here that because of technology, there's such opportunities to drive productivity that it creates significant increases in wages and in incomes and in tax dollars without creating traditionally what we saw in those with those kinds of conditions, which is price inflation? I mean, are economists talking about this?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, definitely. There is not necessarily a difference of huge opinion between people that support the new economy and people that say, well, let's have a little bit more longer memory. You know, we've seen productivity gains before also in the 1960s, and then they went away. Here, if it truly is that we can always have great technology happen, great productivity keep continuing to go on, then, yes, these things can still continue. I would myself be a little leery to say that productivity is such that it's going to keep growing at that high, high level. I sort of look back as cycles of the economy have happened. We went through agriculture. Agriculture had tremendous productivity gains, and that allowed people to move out of agriculture, and the manufacturing took off. And now we're essentially having great productivity gains, which is taking people out of manufacturing, because if you can do more with the same resources, you don't need as many resources. And that's allowing then our information economy to take off. It's allowing those resources to flow into that direction. And so I think there's finally going to be a point where if the information aspect age of our economy can have productivity gains, then, yeah, it can continue. But I would be a little leery to say that we're definitely in some new economy where we have very unusually high productivity gains by historical standards.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Sarah Gates, an economist with the Office of Economic Analysis, and I'd like you to turn to page 9 in your packet, and I'll give you the December 1 revenue forecast. As you know, we released this a little before Thanksgiving, but it definitely does impact what you're looking at. The basic news for 9901 is very little change. If you look at the top of page 9, there's a chart showing you the December forecast compared to the September and the close of session. And really, there are a couple of changes to pay attention to. One is that we've increased the personal income tax forecast back to the level of that we had at in the close of session. We'd seen weaker collections initially, but then they were stronger in the quarter ending in September. And we had stronger income growth that drove a little higher level to the forecast. Corporate income tax, we've reduced by $74 million, and that's following weaker collections, which continue all the way through November. We're seeing coming in slightly under forecast consistently, and we've included a slightly weaker corporate profit forecast for Oregon in this forecast. The other change, which relates to a topic you talked about earlier today, is that we've lowered our cigarette tax forecast, and that's responsible for the $4.8 million decrease in the other section of the forecast, and that's in response to higher prices. So the net result is that we've increased general fund revenues by $10 million. That increases the ending balance to $126.8 million. That's about $81 million higher than you had at the close of session. One other thing I will point out is in the forecast document, we published for a second time the close of session page and the reason, or close of session numbers, and the reason is there were several bills that had not been signed when we had to publish the September forecast, and so the final close of session numbers are contained in the December forecast, just keep in mind. At the bottom of page 9 is the lottery forecast for the current biennia, and you will see very small changes in the lottery forecast for this biennium all the way through the close of the 2001 fiscal year. And the reason for that is that we have an agreement with lottery to transfer just the close of session amount to the Economic Development Fund, and they're retaining any additional earnings that they've gotten from lottery gaming in their contingency fund to be used to purchase new video terminals over the next few years, and this is something that is in their long-term plan. But they are also giving us a guarantee that we're going to get what we've anticipated in terms of the close of session amount. The slight increase that is shown here is due to interest income increases on the Economic Development Fund. As a result, we have an ending balance of $3.3 million that would carry forward into the 2001-03 biennia. In terms of how the forecast is tracking, right at the moment we are basically dead on with our December forecast, so actuals for October and November are only slightly different than we anticipated, so that's a good sign. If you'll turn to page 10, I'd like to go through next biennial forecast, and that is the one that you will obviously be thinking about as tentative budgets are put together and you're anticipating any kind of tax issues or revenue issues for next session. The top of the page shows the general fund forecast, and our beginning balance is $10 million higher than we had in the September forecast. That just carries through from the 9901, so that's $10 million up. Personal income taxes, the level adjustment that we put in the 9901 forecast is carried through, which increases revenues by a little over $72 million. The corporate income tax forecast itself is actually lower in association with those lower corporate profits I talked about, but because we lowered the corporate forecast in 1991, we're just slightly under the 2% kicker threshold for that biennia, and as a result, there's no kicker included in this forecast, and the net result is that we have more resources available in 2103. That's what the positive $54 million is due to. And finally, in other revenues, we've reduced it for the cigarette tax reduction that we talked about just a minute ago. Net result is that you have $120 million more for the 2103 biennia than you thought you did in September for a slightly over $11.1 billion. Lottery forecast is also up slightly, and that's mainly due to an adjustment to the interest income forecast on the Economic Development Fund and slightly stronger gaming revenues. At the bottom of that, the chart that's for lottery, you'll see that dedicated distributions are actually projected to be higher than in the 2103 biennia by $42 million. And the reason for that is a lottery bond package was issued last month. And at the time of the September forecast, we were anticipating a much smaller bond issuance than actually happened. They reorganized it in response to the initiative petitions that are out there to eliminate video lottery, and issued, I believe, between $140 and $150 million worth of bonds, and that upped the debt service payments that we are including in the forecast for the 2103 biennia. So the net result is you have a $282 million available for discretionary allocation. That would be for state school fund and economic development mainly, and any other thing that the legislature would choose to spend the money on. If you'll turn to the final page of the packet, which is page 11, it gives you a long-term view of what is happening to general fund revenues. And this chart has two bars on it. The white bar is what actually comes in the bank, as it were. It's just net collections, and it includes things like kicker refunds and federal pension refunds. When you take out those unusual refunds and look at the true revenues that are based on economic activity, you get what's in the black bar. So you can see that in 95-97, we actually had over 23% growth in general fund revenues for the biennia. This last biennia, 97-99, that dropped off to about 14%. And looking forward, we're really hovering around the 10% level. We're not anticipating the spectacular growth we saw earlier in the 90s. And that really links in with what we're forecasting just for the overall Oregon economy, slow, steady growth, but nothing spectacular. And that's something to keep in mind as you're looking at revenue packages for the future. And that's all I have to say. If I'd be happy to address any questions at this time.
Okay. Any questions? We spent quite a bit of time this morning talking about the tobacco settlement and the master agreement that involves most of the states. Now, does that show up anywhere in your forecast numbers?
Mr. Chair, we have not included a forecast or any reflection of those revenues in our forecast to date.
I think that might be a good idea to consider in the future, and I'll tell you why, because we got first a report this morning from a representative from Morgan Stanley, Dean Witter, who gave us one set of numbers. Then the Attorney General came in and had a slightly different set of numbers, even though the dates appeared to be pretty much the same. And I understand that there's another consultant, the Smith Barney Group, that's going to be giving yet another set of numbers to the Senate. And so it's a little hard to have three different sets of numbers. And I think if the if your office actually said, you know, based on the best predictions and at least a snapshot in time, here's a number that everybody can at least start working from, that would be more beneficial to, you know, determining policy and how to spend that, again, depending on what happens to 2007. But that would be, a helpful item to include in future forecast documents.
Mr. Chair, that shouldn't be a problem, and we'll work closely with Legislative Revenue to come up with some numbers that we can include with the March forecast and all future forecasts.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, that's supposed to go forever, at least as long as people are still buying cigarettes.
Any other questions?
Any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jim Buchholz from Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Buchholz. I'm with the Department of Revenue. I'm here to talk kicker. I've got a handout that I believe Ed is handing out to you now that more or less summarizes the process this last year, and it really went quite smoothly this time around. As of November 30th, we had issued almost $157 million in rebates to 1.3 million taxpayers. That's 1.3 million out of the 1.6 million who had filed returns for the 1998 tax year. That 156 million breaks down to a little bit more than $150 million in checks that were printed for 1.2 million taxpayers, and the balance, the 6.6 million, represents approximately 100,000 taxpayers who had their refunds offset. They owed debt to a state agency, and the kicker money was taken to pay that debt. And you can see I've got in Table 2 down below, I've listed the top 10 recipients of the kicker refunds that were offset. Obviously, the vast majority of them went to pay off personal income tax debt. That's $4.5 million. The second one in order of ranking of how we took the refunds or applied the refunds went to Department of Justice, and that's primarily child support, delinquent child support. As far as taxpayer contacts, it's significant this time around, I think, because we had vastly fewer attempts this time around than we have had in the last time. much less than half of the number of attempts of people trying to get in and call and ask us about the about their kicker, and this is due to a number of different reasons. First, I think people are just getting more familiar with the process, and this is the third time around that we've issued checks, and people are getting more or less familiar with it. They know what these are, and they know that they're coming. We also made some changes this last time in running the addresses through U.S. Postal Service database, address updating database, and we changed about 7% of the checks, the addresses on the checks. These normally would have delayed in the mail as they were forwarded, or they would have come back to the Department of Revenue, and as it was, the Postal Service just mailed them on normally. And then I think the biggest reason why we had fewer attempts was because of the dropping of the minimum refund down to $1. This was legislation that you folks passed this last time around. It used to be $5 minimum, and it got dropped to $1. And that meant that 88,000 more folks got checks. They were significant checks. They were between $1 and $5. So, but it did add up. It's $225,000 that these people got, and there were people that weren't calling us asking where their refund was. Of the attempts, we had answered. We answered 7,500 calls in the first 2 weeks after the kicker. So we were quite busy over there answering phone calls. Our website also took a number of hits. The particular page that we had set up for kicker received 5,000 hits in the month of November. It was by far and away the most popular link that we had on our website. The common contacts are the common questions that folks ask. First of all, address changes. People that didn't get to us prior to the kicker coming out, we tried to do as much as possible to advertise to people that they need to get their address updated in order to get their check timely, but there are always people who don't realize that until their neighbors receive their check. And so we got a number of calls on people asking to update their address. We had questions about offsets, people that had, instead of receiving a check, had received a letter explaining where and why their refund was applied to that particular debt. And then
Jim, was that the result of a specific piece of legislation as well, the offset, or is that just
Mr. Chair, no, that was standing policy. That was in from the beginning. Okay. It's always been there. Then the last question that we get is, where's my refund? Most of these people are people that are under $1, where their check would calculate to a rebate of less than a dollar, and by a statute they don't get one. And then, of course, there's always some people who call us asking where their refund is that haven't filed a return. We help them out. On page 2, I've listed in table 3, I've listed the costs to issue the rebate. It doesn't show a significant difference between the budgeted cost and where we are now. Primarily, it's because most of the costs haven't come through yet. We haven't gotten them finalized, so there's a good deal of plan in the actual plus plan. But I think our research area did an exceptional job this year in estimating the number of refund checks that would go out, and so I think that these numbers are going to hold. I think they're really quite accurate. A couple of items of miscellaneous info. It took us 5 weeks to calculate the checks and get them printed and stuffed. We did the calculation at the Department of Revenue and sent them over to State Printer to have them printed and stuffed and mailed out. This is the second year or the second time that we've done that, partnered with State Printer, and it's actually working out quite well for us. It's relieved a resource burden for the Department of Revenue. And then lastly, we've got about 15,000 checks that we've received that were returned unclaimed, where the address was bad or just was undeliverable for one reason or another. We're in the process now of researching those to try to find a better address for the taxpayer to get them their rebate. The ones that we can't find, we'll hold for a period and then transfer them over to state lands in the normal process there. I'd be happy to take questions.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Any questions? Representative Kapoori?
You said that there were 88,000 checks that were between $1 and $5 that we find it. I looked on this handy-dandy revenue measures research report that we got. And under Senate Bill 256, which was the bill Department of Revenue estimated that there would be 14,000 refund checks. Do you know why there was such a discrepancy between what the estimate was and how many were actually?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kapori, I can only anticipate that the 14,000 were in the normal course of business, that in a non-kicker year. Most people do a pretty good job of adjusting their withholding if they're not going to owe tax or if their refund is going to be $5 or less. But I don't know. It may have been just a miss.
Who made that prediction? Maybe he's in the room. Any other questions? Now, Jim, this cost of issuing the refunds or the actual checks comes out of the total kicker amounts, isn't that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, so you said all the costs aren't in there yet, so how do you know how much to withhold in order to pay the expenses?
Mr. Chair, the costs are all in the budgeted cost. It's all in the estimate. We can estimate it pretty closely. I think what I was trying to say is that in the second column there, the actual plus plan, the vast majority of that is still plan. It's expected. The actuals that are coming through are lagging.
You don't have the actual invoices yet.
Right. Most of the cost to issuing the kicker in the first few months is in personal services. Mm-hmm. And while that's a significant portion, the budgeted part is $131,000, and we're very close to that. Most of the cost is in the S&S items, and that won't come in until later. What I was trying to say, though, is that we did a pretty good job of estimating the number of checks, so I think that that's pretty accurate. The estimates that we have, I think, will hold.
All right. Thank you. Anything else? Okay, we'll move to our last item, the review of Measure 76. And what that means since the voters approved it.
Mr. Chair, the Secretary of State released the final vote count on Measure 76, which was in the past November election, which amended the Constitution to put new language in. If you're familiar with the new language, essentially says that the highway taxes that are imposed by the state, motor fuel taxes, any taxes on vehicles for registration and so on, need to be adjusted so that the classes of vehicles, light and heavy, are each paying their proportionate share of the cost that they cause in terms of the either viewed from the standpoint of damage to the highways or in terms of the expenditures from the highway fund that are made because of the use of the highways by different classes of vehicles. So the first page is the vote as it took place by county. I just organized it here so that you have, first of all, the Eastern Oregon counties and then the Western Oregon counties. You can see that the measure did not pass, essentially, in Eastern Oregon, but did pass in Western Oregon, with Washington County having the largest plurality of votes.
And was doing some work.
I would like to know why Representative Butler didn't do a better job opening.
Loop it to switch.
Or Representative Close.
Overall, voter turnout was fairly light for this measure. It varied by the what was being voted on, but for this measure, it's pretty close on both the east and west side at about 26.5%. And eventually, you actually have a majority of the counties voting against the measure, but the popular vote was 54% overall, with only 47% on the east side and 55% on the west side.
Okay.
As I noted, the language at the top of the next page is the language that you added to the Constitution there. The section 3A of Article 9 there deals with, taxes on motor vehicle fuel or any taxes or excises on the ownership, operation, or use of motor vehicles. And those are dedicated to the construction, improvement, maintenance, and operation of highways. Now, the constitutional amendment there, the additional language, applies only to taxes and fees that are imposed by the state. The broader language in the first part of this article applies to any revenues collected, whether they're by the state, cities, counties, or whatever road districts might impose fees. So if a city imposes a fuel tax, the revenues from that must be spent on the roads. But under the new language here, you're speaking only to the state-imposed taxes. So it would be registration fees and motor vehicle fuel taxes that are imposed by the state. And some of those revenues from the taxes imposed by the state are shared with local government. Those are also included. But all revenues that are derived from state-imposed taxes. So I think the language here makes it clear what the overall intent is, and that is that for light vehicles, for light and heavy vehicles as a class, what they pay as a result of the tax rate structures that you impose has to be proportional to what's spent because of those vehicles on the highways. The implication, of course, is you're going to know that. And that's why in the past we've done highway cost allocation studies. And that's, you know, one thing you might want to do statutorily to sort of augment the constitutional requirement now is to require that you be provided that sort of information so that you'll have some basis to make the judgment as to whether or not you're complying with the constitutional requirement. The other thing is that it doesn't really define what's a light vehicle and what's a heavy vehicle. So again, statutorily, you might want to come back and identify what it is specifically that must be balanced there in terms of what the two classes. And it does require, the last sentence there of this paragraph, requires that the legislative assembly take action, but requires you to modify some of these taxes. Doesn't say which ones. It could be the motor fuel taxes. It could be the registration fees. To modify some taxes to achieve this balance, this proportionality between costs and revenues paid. And that's about where you are right now in terms of what the constitutional amendment, the change in the language, says. If House Bill 2082, which has been a referendum, the initiative petitions have been gathered and the bill has been referred to the people, and if that referendum passes, there is language, again, statutory language now, in House Bill 3344, which is conditioned, the language is conditioned on the referral of 2082, if you recall that maze we went through. If it passes, if the voters approve this on the May 15th election, then this additional statutory language sort of applies. And it does address some of the issues that I mentioned earlier. It does require that the Office of Economic Analysis that presented the forecast here actually do highway cost allocation studies. They do those every 2 years, provide you, again, the information to evaluate whether or not there is proportionality between costs and revenues. And it also requires them to report to the legislature, and it requires that they recommend adjustments. And it gets specific here in the types of adjustments that can be made, or not can be made, but at least the recommendations will apply to. And the reference here in subsection 2, in the middle of the page there, to ORS 803-420-10, those are the registration fees that apply to vehicles. Commercial vehicles, commercial vehicles, essentially.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Butler,
just one observation. In the May 2000 referrals, it does give a definition whether it's passed into law or not. It does give a definition of light versus heavy, but that may not be binding upon Measure 76 language as is finally defined. So, but there is a 26,000 and less, and then 26,001 and more.
I think what Dick is saying is that the constitutional language is supported by this part of the statute in 2082. But now that that's been referred, if that's defeated, then there may be legislative action required to replicate at least this section in statute.
In statute.
In order to effectively carry out the mandate of the constitutional amendment. Is that accurate?
Yes, to address those issues at least. You couldn't replicate this because it applies to a section of the bill.
Well, I didn't mean in the exact.
That's correct.
Concept.
That's correct. If it does pass, then you've already taken these statutory actions to sort of implement the constitutional provision. In point three, subsection three, it does say that the legislative action required again by the constitutional amendment shall be with respect to those fees for commercial vehicles to achieve the proportionality required by the Constitution. And in subsection 4, it speaks to the issue you just raised, and that is it defines what a light vehicle is and what a heavy vehicle is, and the dividing line there is 26,000 pounds. That first section that we just looked at is an amendment in House Bill 3344, which takes out some of the language that's in 2082, but it's amending the same section. So it's since 3344 was not referred, it takes effect, and this is what will become the statutory language. In addition, House Bill 3344 had a Section 38 in it, and this, speaks to the issue of having DOS collect data that's going to be useful in the analysis of cost responsibility, and it directs them to collect data that's required. And it also gives them the authority, essentially, to determine what constitutes a class of heavy vehicles. So you're looking at it not only just light and heavy, but looking also within the heavy vehicle class. You may have separate subclasses, if you like, of heavy vehicles, which would be important from the standpoint of whether or not there are significant divergence from cost responsibility among those subclasses. And it allows the Office of Economic Analysis to define what are reasonable classes or subclasses of heavy vehicles. And it directs the office essentially to use that data and that information as a factor in arriving at its recommended adjustment. It has to report back to the legislature.
Any questions? Dick, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dick, I'm just going to try to make a statement, and then you tell me if it's right or wrong, because this is a question that comes up in every town hall meeting I've had since the session. Does this language that we just put in the Constitution essentially just describe what is the practice already, but it is not anywhere in law? That wasn't a statement. That was a question. Do you agree with that question?
Well, I think there's a difference. There's a difference between sort of a tradition which Oregon has had of following cost responsibility. Traditionally, what's happened is that the Department of Transportation has done the highway cost allocation studies, and they've come to the legislature with a recommendation, usually involving just the weight mile tax rates, but sometimes broader, involving other taxes and fees, which they sort of certify or posit that those will achieve cost responsibility as closely as they can, both between heavy vehicles and automobiles or light vehicles, but also within the heavy vehicle classes. That's sort of the tradition. But now we've had a very significant change, or if 2082 is passed by the voters, we will have had a very significant change in the tax structure. And that tool is not really available anymore, that weight mile tax structure. So there's some concern, I think, about how that tradition is continued, if you want to continue it. And you could have had statutory language, again, directing yourself to do that. And that would be stronger in some sense than just a tradition. But what you've got now is a constitutional sort of mandate that at least for these two classes, heavy and light, that you achieve some proportionality between costs and revenue. So I think it's different, but I don't know if that answers.
And if I could just follow up.
Sure.
I understand that these sections 40 and 38 would only take effect if the referendum passes. But this new language that's at the top of that page, that will be in the Constitution regardless.
That is.
And that is in the Constitution right now. And does that language put a new obligation on the legislature? And if so, what's the enforcing mechanism for that?
The answer is yes to the first part of the question. It's something you've never had to deal with before. It's a constitutional requirement that you follow that language, and you have, you know, some latitude in interpreting exactly what that language is. And if you, if someone feels that you violated that language, then they have a legal course of action, which would be to go to the courts and try to. At this
like
point, we're getting into into a legal question, and Joan Robinson is here from counsel, and maybe can address that if she'd like to, but maybe she wouldn't either.
Well, we did talk about that during the discussion of this whole measure, and that was, what's the enforcement?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Joan Robinson, Legislative Council. That's the question. Not clear whether any court would issue a writ of mandamus to the legislature commanding them to do something. I think if the legislature does do something, then virtually anything they do would be upheld by the courts. I think the courts will not second-guess a legislative determination of what's fair, what's proportional, what constitutes a study, what constitutes a class. But I think the only real enforcement question would arise if, for example, the legislature does a study or asks someone else to do a study, the study shows pretty clear disproportion, and the legislature doesn't do anything to adjust the tax rate. Some courts, but as far as I know, not the Oregon Supreme Court, have essentially said in situations where something was mandated and wasn't done, some courts have taken over and done it. Federal courts, for example, have imposed school busing, things like that. I think it's a situation that neither a court nor a legislature likes to get in. It's a horrifying situation to have. I mean, the thought of the court writing the tax tables horrifies me. It may not horrify some members of this committee, though.
Well, that's true. The Revenue Committee might like that.
So it's not clear how the mandate would be enforced. The Supreme Court doesn't have an army over there. They might have a marshal they could send over, but what the marshal could do to you, I don't know. I can't answer the question.
Well, we did talk about that at one point, about having it say that the executive branch would do it in the event the legislature doesn't. But, you know, I really can't imagine you being accountable to the voters and saying, we choose to disregard
the will of the voters?
Yeah, a section of the Oregon Constitution and just not do it. I don't think you'd get away with that. And I think also how I would answer your constituent question is, what Dick said, but just to say that the mechanism before, the way truck taxes were collected on a weight mile basis, had cost responsibility as a essential component of that. But if we're going to a diesel tax, then assigning this cost responsibility principle to that method of collecting maintains that same practice just through a different collection mechanism. Okay?
Thank you.
Any other questions? Joan, Dick? Anyone want to add anything in the audience?
Good answer.
Okay. Well, I think we're through our agenda. We've covered a lot of territory today. You have a lot of reading material. And we will not meet again as the committee until February 24th of 2000, so be sure to mark that on your calendar. But as I mentioned this morning, there may be some other communication that will go to you regarding workers' comp subcommittee and some material on local option and things like that. So you might be watching your mailbox for that. Anything else? If not, we're adjourned. Thank you very much. Merry Christmas.